Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 229. What keeps your spark alive for developing software and learning Python? Do you like to try new frameworks, build toy projects, or collaborate with other developers? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week, bringing another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. We discuss the joy of tinkering with Python as a way to keep your developer's skills sharp. We dig into our techniques for continuing to learn and build projects. Christopher shares an article examining the performance of Python 3.13's free threading features. The piece uses a clever example to measure how it behaves with large datasets and parallelization. We share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including a group of new releases, common use cases and examples for Python closures, finding the opposite of cloud native, exploring Python's soft keywords, a command line utility for taking automated screenshots of websites, and putting the Django admin in the terminal with Textual. This episode is brought to you by Windsurf, the first truly agentic AI-powered IDE, created by the Codeium team. Windsurf combines the best of copilots and agents to bring you tomorrow's editor today. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Christopher, welcome back.
Hey there.
All right, we're digging in with actually a few pieces of news this week and our usual links and projects. So what do you got for us?
Yeah, a few release announcements. Somehow it's a week without anything to say about a Python alpha, which makes me very, very disappointed. I don't know what those lazy guys at the PSF have been doing.
All right.
Anyhow, Django 5.1.3 came out. It has a couple minor bug fixes in this one. You don't have to hurry out to it. But they did add the Python 3.13 support to their test suite. So if you were mucking around with 3.13 in Django, then you might want to grab that.
Okay.
Next up is the release of Pillow 11. Pillow's an image library, which originally forked off of Pill, which is kind of funny that we keep saying that, seeing as it's probably been Pillow longer than it was Pill. But then I still tweet on Twitter, so who am I to know, right? X. Anyways, this right. release had a few changes, but mostly was a compatibility release with older versions of Python and operating systems removed and a bunch of stuff deprecated. And similarly, the other release this week is Flask 3.1. Like with Pillow, there's a couple small things in there, but mostly it's about dropping Python 3.8 testing and updating some dependencies.
It's nice to be able to do that for them, I'm guessing.
You know? It's always good. Less code to check.
Yep.
And then the other bit of news is the call for proposals for PyCon US 2025 is out. Next year's conference is in Pittsburgh. So if you want to give a talk or a tutorial, it's time to submit a proposal.
All right. Well, that gets us right into our topics this week. I have a Real Python one. It's from our friend, Leodon Esposo Ramos. And this one is about Python closures. The subtitle is Common Uses and Examples. So kind of a tour of some functionality that's built into Python that maybe you aren't familiar with or the terminology. It's interesting that this idea of a closure is a common feature of functional programming languages. And again, it shows this sort of flexibility of Python, this idea that it can work in so many different directions and ways that you'd want. And I think that's one of the most appealing things about Python to people. This is giving you an idea of it. You might have already used some of these things that I'm going to tour through. But the idea of a closure is a function that's defined inside of another function. There's a little bit of difference there. We're going to get into it. He starts with this concept that, okay, sure, you're defining a function inside of another function, and it can access or update objects that are inside that enclosing function. And his first example that he provides is showing off the concept that all closures are inner functions, but not all inner functions are closures. And so the difference there is this idea that you can build that sort of structurally, but if you don't have it return this inner function object from the outer function, then it's really not truly kind of a closure. It's not providing that functionality. And so, yes, functions can return functions, and functions can accept a function. And that's where we hit our favorite sound effect, because everything in Python is an object. Yeah, there we go. Three components that he says you need to have here is an outer or enclosing function, variables that are local to that outer function, and then an inner or nested function defined inside the outer function. And then in that particular case, the inner function object returns from the outer function. So the techniques that are shown, he shows creating closures to retain the state of stuff. One example would be a factory function, a function that returns a function defined by parameters that are given to it. This is a really common example I always see is something mathematical. It's like, okay, you can have this thing that raises something to the power of something. So you have a function that returns a function that you can say, well, I want it to raise things to the sixth power or the fifth power. He does the opposite here. He does a root calculator as an example. So kind of flipping on its head a little bit. But if you're not familiar with this idea of functions creating functions, this is a little bit of introduction of this concept. He talks about stateful functions, a closure that is used to retain the state between function calls. He provides an example of building like a cumulative average. So every time that you run this thing with a new value, the average is being updated and the state is being retained inside the function. He talks about GUI libraries a little bit and how you can have a callback function, and provides an example of like a button being assigned a particular command that has this callback that's, again, this function calling a function. Decorators, which is a very deep rabbit hole. The example that's there is kind of small. And if you leave it scratching your head a little bit, like, oh, what's going on with this? I definitely suggest looking at the associated tutorials that are not only linked in there, but also like I created a video course about decorators and give you an idea of this function sort of wrapping around another function and that being returned out of it. So again, a closure. Memoization is another one. We've talked about that in the past, this idea of sort of caching things. So you could prevent a function from running more than once if you wanted to set something up like that. You can have it say, okay, if it is the same input that I've received before, then just return this value or this function. So interesting idea there. He talks a little bit about encapsulation, which is a hard word for me to say, with closures. The idea there is like you'd like to prevent access to certain items. If you create something using object-oriented programming techniques, he uses an example of creating a class that is a stack and having functions for pushing and popping items out of it. The problem with it is that you can still access what should be inaccessible things, like the actual items in the stack, by just using like dot notation. And so there's another way that you could do that. And he gives an example of using it it's designed in a similar way, but you cannot access the individual items by building it as a function with functions inside of it. He gives a little section about sort of alternatives to closures. And then it's a nice tour. I don't know which ones of these that you typically use are in practice of using, Christopher.
It's decorators mostly, I think.
Yeah.
I don't do a lot of functional programming. It's not where my head naturally goes. I'm a procedural first guy. It seems to be my natural way of doing algorithms. But there are cases where sometimes it's the right tool for the job.
Yeah. So I like this as a nice tour of like, okay, what they are and how they kind of work in Python, but also some examples of using them in practice. And each of them have a nice little code example with them to give you a tour. So thanks, lay it on us. What's your first one?
My first article this week is called State of Python 3.13 Performance, Free Threading. It's by Arthur Pestel, and he has done a deep dive on performance in your favorite language. He's written a short version of the PageRank algorithm, which is what Google originally used to decide the order of search ranking. He picked this as it's compute intensive, as well as uses a fair amount of data. This is important if you're measuring performance in threading situations, because threads tend to be a better choice when there's a lot of I/O. So Arthur writes several versions of this same algorithm, a single-threaded one, a multi-threaded one, and a multi-processor one. He then uses PyTest to build out a test suite and does some timings. So you'll recall that Python 3.13 has an experimental feature to remove the gil. This is a compile time flag, so you have to have a special version of the interpreter to use it. If you do have that flag compiled in, you can turn the gil on and off. And as the phrase no gil is on or off can be confusing because of the double negative, this is known as the free threaded version. The free threaded version is denoted with a T. So Arthur runs his three page rank variants in Python 3.12.7 and then three versions of 3.13. One without the free threaded compiled in, and then two of those T versions, one with the gil on and one with the gil off.
Okay.
So in single threaded mode, 3.12 and vanilla 3.13 perform similarly, with 3.13 being 0.04 seconds faster at a total of 1.44 seconds to do the test. The two T variants are actually a little bit slower. They're about 0.3 seconds longer, clocking in at 1.7 seconds. And I know 0.3 doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a 20% slowdown. So if you were doing larger loads, this would make a difference. Since this is single-threaded, you wouldn't expect a speed-up anyways, as the whole point of T-mode is threading improvements. The downside here is you are seeing a little bit of a performance drop because of T-mode.
Okay.
But of course, this is something the core maintainers are planning on working on in future versions. Anyways, so the next set of tests runs those same four interpreters, but using the threaded version of the program. Interestingly, three of the versions are slower. So 3.12 and 3.13 take 1.8 seconds, which is 28% slower. So just by going into threaded mode versus single threaded mode, you're actually losing some performance. And likewise, the T version with the gil turned off is actually getting pretty bad at 2.3 seconds. Of course, that's not what you came here for, though. I'm happy to say that the T version with the gil off just smoked the competition, coming in at 0.4 seconds total. So that's a 70% improvement in performance. And this is why we want to get rid of the gil, because that's a big leap.
Yeah.
Then the last set of tests is the multi-processor version. The PageRank algorithm does use the CPU, but it's more I/O intensive, so it's not something you'd normally choose multiprocessing for. And you'll see why when I start talking, or you'll hear why when I start talking about the results.
Yeah, you may want to look at the graph.
So 3.12 and 3.13 vanilla take almost twice as long as the single-threaded versions. So you're seeing a real hit here. And this is due to the overhead of spawning new processes. Somewhat worryingly, the T versions with and without the gil are horrific, coming in at over 6 seconds. So that's almost five times as long.
Yeah.
Granted, this isn't something that the T version has been optimized for yet, and it doesn't mean it will always be this way, but it does show you how complicated this kind of adventure is. Performance improvements for some folks may mean performance degradation for others, and in fact, this is what has killed no-gil projects in the past, is the improvements in one place were coming at too high a cost in others. Arthur closes out by noting that none of the code takes advantage of the sub-interpreter's features, which is yet another kind of wrinkle in all of this that might be worth investigating. So you always hear things like faster and better, and it's kind of nice to see the actual effects of these things in practice.
Yeah, I expect to see many more articles in this vein.
Yeah.
It makes me think a little bit about kind of the dawn of the multiprocessor stuff. I was working in music at the time, and speed of processors was sort of capping out. Mm-hmm. And so we added more and more processors, but a lot of code, or, you know, in this case it was audio plugins, was written in a way, I guess, that it couldn't do exactly these types of things. It had this chart literally showing me all the different processors, and it's only using the first two. Like, why is it not even bothering? And I'm guessing that has to do with, like, you know, again, how code can be written and how it can take advantage across it.
It's, you know, one of the challenges in concurrency is always problems that are trivially parallel, as in it usually means I'm doing, you know, I've got this big chunk of data and I can chunk it up into pieces and I can process each one of those pieces.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, you almost always have to do something single-threaded in order to chunk the data up. and then something single-threaded to take the pieces and reassemble them.
Right.
And there's a cost of that. So the gain you get by doing things in parallel has to be significant. Otherwise, the cost of splitting the problem up and reassembling it may actually turn out that it was just faster to do it without.
Yeah. You talked about I/O, you know, or anything ever hitting a network, right?
Yeah. So yeah. And it's just even without I/O, even with like numeric computations, you have the same thing, right? Like if I'm trying to brute force an algorithm and I've got several different matrices that I'm trying to run at the same time, I still have to decide how am I chunking up that in memory and how am I accessing all of that.
Yeah.
And concurrency is very hard to get right. And that's without getting into, you know, the kinds of bugs that are Heisen bugs that show up when you're trying to code in that kind of space.
Yeah, definitely.
Calling all Python developers. Supercharge your next project with Windsurf by Codeium, the first truly agentic AI-powered IDE. Designed to keep you in constant flow state, Windsurf combines the best of both Copilot and Agent systems, incorporating all the features you loved from the Codeium extensions while also introducing Cascade, a multi-step reasoning agent that has access to the tools, unprecedented context awareness, and insights to prior actions. This means less prompting and more coding. Ready to dream bigger? Visit windsurf.ai and try out tomorrow's editor today for free.
My next one is from Michael Kennedy. Yes, that Michael Kennedy from Talk Python. This is an article on his blog. I kind of like this trend that Michael has over the years that he kind of likes to work a little bit in the open, showing people what he's doing. Like I see conversations started on social network about, oh, I'm trying out this new SEO methodology, or I'm trying out this thing or whatever. And so this is kind of similar. I've seen him talk over the last month or so about this new hosting option. And I kind of wondered where all this was headed. And well, he wrote it up as a blog post here. And he wrote a description of how he thinks about structuring sort of business applications. I feel that very often people think of a business some ways that it's always going to be this thing that's going to blow up and be like way huger. You know, they're always looking for that viral moment, that's what things are gearing for. But many businesses are going to have a sort of a steady sort of growth or decline or whatever, or just some sort of constant. It's pretty rare that things 10x, 1000x or whatever. But I mean, it is feasible. So he talks about this with this idea of what is the opposite of cloud native. Cloud native is this idea of, it's kind of like the next level of microservices, in my opinion, like all these different things that you can build to support putting up a business application on the web. He shows an example of that structure, and it's massive. It's like this big drawing with all the different types of things that are happening. I feel like this is a common sort of laundry list of services from providers like AWS or Azure. And he provides setting all that up and gives you an idea of what that might lead to as far as like monthly billing or something like that. And in the end, it might be leading toward like around $1,000 a month or something like that. He also shares a link to like a horror story of a particular one of these services, this thing called Kara.app, and it literally did go viral. And in that particular case, with this sort of structure, they ended up with this insane monthly bill of like $96,000 a month. The idea of sort of building for this really expandable setup, I think, is a little misleading. So he's providing a new option that he's calling Stack Native. His quote is, Stack Native is building your app with just enough full stack building blocks to make it run reliably with minimal complexity. He's trying to contrast it. The other kind of contrast that he has is like going back maybe a couple decades, how a company might build something in-house on premises, but you'd have physical servers in your business. You'd have all the Ethernet wiring. You'd have to be paying and for a fairly large pipe to an ISP, backup power systems, someone to have a pager and jump in for support and so forth. And the idea that was happening over the last two decades was that, okay, well, we're going to lift this and host it somewhere else and duplicating that setup in the cloud. And again, being a rather cost prohibitive way of doing things. So he details his particular simplified setup, Flask being the center of that, Flask being managed by Docker and potentially scaling up using web workers. It could be run directly on a VM. He has workers running with a WSGI, WSGI Python server, and then a web app exposed to the internet via Nginx. He talks about self-hosted database, something like Postgres or MongoDB, everything being open source, excluding the cloud at VM. And he buys a medium-sized server. He was using, previously he was using something like DigitalOcean. But he recently switched to this new service called Hetzner, H-E-T-Z-N-E-R, which I think it's new that they have US-based data centers. And so they're a German company that's now providing now these US resources. So he digs a little bit more into the details, shares some stats about the typical traffic his sites get. And that is to say, these are not toy example apps. He's hosting his whole business on this type of setup. Not only the podcast that he does, but he does, training courses and so forth. So one of the big things is the bandwidth bill. And the difference in cost for that stuff is a tenth of that price. So it's closer to just over $100 a month for what he's doing. I don't know if he's including the price of where all the files are saved. I'm guessing that's maybe not included there if he's still using S3, but it's an interesting article. It's giving you an idea of the changes of infrastructure from over the last several decades, the allure that is of cloud native and the danger that you can get into there. And he's hinting at making a course about this sort of structure and suggests staying tuned to his blog for future developments. I like how he included lots of links to not only stories like the horror story I mentioned, but other services to check out and other utilities and explainers on certain concepts. So I appreciate the linking there. I definitely enjoyed that part of it.
He also just wrote a follow-up as well, which is specifically on the transfer to Hetzner.
Okay.
So
cool. All right. I'll include a link for that then as an additional link.
Yeah. It'll be in, when this podcast comes out, it will have been in last week's PyCoders.
Nice.
I'm time traveling.
Yeah. All right. Well, what do you got for us next?
My next article is from Rodrigo Hiro Serriero and is one of his Things I've Learned posts titled Python's Soft Keywords. So a regular keyword in Python is a part of the language syntax that can't be used as a variable. For example, if you try to assign a value to a variable named if, you'll get a syntax error as if is a keyword. So a soft keyword is still a keyword, but it's based on context and you can actually use them as variables. But if you use them in the right way, then they're part of the syntax. This has been done to help with backwards compatibility. If you add new syntax to the language, there's always a chance that that keyword is a variable in somebody's older code, and all of a sudden you're going to break a bunch of stuff. So being a soft keyword gets around this problem. Python 3.12 has four soft keywords. Two of them are match and case, which were introduced in Python 3.10 as part of the structural pattern matching feature. Somewhat less obvious, but actually also associated with match and case, is the underscore. I use underscores all the time when a function returns a tuple and I only want part of it. Unpacking part of a tuple into an underscore works as a signal to sort of say, hey, I don't care about this part. The underscore is also part of the match case piece, being a specific case in structural pattern matching. So three of the four soft keywords are actually match case stuff. And then the fourth soft keyword was added as part of Python 3.12, and that's the word type. This is part of the typing system, which allows you to create type aliases. The article came out before 3.13, and so the references are all about 3.12. But if you actually want to see what soft keywords your variant supports, you can do that by using the keyword module. This module has a value called soft KW list, all one word, no underscores, that contains the list of soft keyword names. Python 3.13 has the same four that I just spoke about. So interesting quick little article. Rodrigo writes great content, and in fact, he's got a lot of other stuff on his site as well, which I definitely recommend checking out.
Yeah.
This week, I want to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. It covers a powerful concept in Python and touches on one of the main topics this week. It's titled Python Inner Functions. It's based on a RealPython article by Leodon Esposo Ramos. And in the video course, my co-host, Christopher Trudeau, takes you through how to provide encapsulation and hide your functions from external access, how to write helper functions to facilitate code reuse, and create closure factory functions that retain state between calls. You also learn about coding decorator functions to add behavior to existing functions. I think it's a worthy investment of your time to learn how to nest functions inside other functions. It's a feature of Python you'll see more often the further you explore the language. Unlock these features yourself and explore encapsulation, closures, decorators, and much more. RealPython video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the techniques shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the enhanced search tool on realpython.com.
Well, that takes us into our discussion this week. And this week, we're returning to an article by Vadim Gravchenko, and it's titled Habits of Great Software Engineers. You might remember us talking about a couple points from that. It was a big list of habits, and this one we're focusing on number 3, which is the joy of tinkering, and it might be one of my favorites from the list of habits. The brief description he provides is build projects, try out frameworks, build stuff on the side, keeps the sparks alive. And in a longer section of the article, he shares the concept of passion. And a lot of people have passion for programming. And what that means is they're always kind of thinking about, like, oh, how can I use this? Or are interested in new languages. They're like, oh, well, what is this? How does this work in this particular language? And how are they using that? I know a lot of the core developers think about that often and think about ways of inserting that stuff into Python. Other tricks of keeping the spark alive, getting you out of a rut, being curious, or just generally keeping your skills sharp. I think it falls into, for me, definitely the area of enjoying solving problems and trying out new tools and seeing what can happen. I think there's a few different areas we can kind of explore here in our discussion of it. And I wondered about, for you in particular, Christopher, like what are, I kind of had 3 ideas of like how people might approach tinkering. I think there are some people who like to tinker with an existing project or framework that they have. In that particular case, they might fork it and then try out their experiments over there and see what they can do with that, or potentially pulling down other people's work and doing the same thing. I think there are other people that are more artist sketchbook type of people where they'll create like a toy project that have probably very little purpose in their own life, but they want to try something out and they're just going to explore and mess with the framework, but they're not necessarily going to save that work, or maybe they just keep it in a repository that they, you know, don't keep public. They're just like, okay, this is something that I'm just messing with code on here. And then I think there are other people that create sort of finished micro projects, things that are very, very specific and maybe are scratching a very specific itch that they had. But as far as like the popularity of it, they're not as interested in that. They're much more interested in just like, I want to try this stuff out and build tools there. And then I'll explain later, like my own kind of thing with this, where I fall in kind of sort of slightly different area. But I feel like based upon our conversation in the past, I feel like you might fall in my third category there.
Yeah, definitely for Python, I fall into the third category. The reason I'm being specific about the language is,
okay,
some of my approach to tinkering has to do with how much I know about the language, because I've been doing Python for, I think I'm almost at, I'm past the 15 year mark. I have to look it up. I'm old. Let's just leave okay. it at that. I'm old. And so because I've got a fairly good grasp on the language, I'm finding I don't need the, I wouldn't go to the artist sketchbook kind of thing as much. I have a problem I'm trying to solve. And so it tends to be that kind of thing.
Yeah.
There's a fine line between tinkering and yak shaving. And
I always wondered about that term, and there's another term that I don't know if it fits the same thing, but wood shedding or bike shedding.
Yeah, they're phrases generally meaning you're playing with stuff where you're not really getting benefit out of it, I think. Okay. Is really what it comes down to. You're spending more time on the thing because you're maybe because you're perfecting it or because you're reorganizing it and it doesn't really need it.
Okay.
I think all programmers are kind of prone to this somewhat. And I think in the tinkering space, it's more likely to happen. One of the libraries we've talked about before, I've got a little thing that is for visualizing, which I do with the courses. It looks like I'm coding live and I'm not. It's like a little slideshow-y thing inside of the terminal. And it's built on top of a mostly defunct terminal library called Erwid. It's working fine. I don't have to touch it. In the background, every once in a while, I want to try to get it to a more modern underlying library. There's no reason to do that. There's no feature I'm going to get out of it.
Yeah.
You know, I might be able to write better user tests, but I've got a test harness. It's working. So that's very much sort of the tinkering. That's like playing with another way of attaching the problem. And I know that the hours I've soaked into that, the benefit I'm going to get out of it is nothing in comparison to the amount of time it's taken. I also find sometimes this kind of stuff, it's procrastination in search of a solution.
Okay.
When I was writing the book, one of the challenges I've had in the past, I think the first time I ran into it was for a course, was one of the gaming courses that I wrote, where I had like five different versions, because like you're just adding code, you're adding code, and you're adding code, and you end up with a different version, and each version is separate for the students, so they can go, oh, in lesson two, this is what the code looks like, and in lesson five, this is what the code looks like.
Right, because you're learning all these unique concepts that you have to sort of insert. Yeah.
And you don't want to leave them at just the end. Well, the problem is if you find a bug in chapter 10, you have to go back and make sure you change it in all the previous chapters. So I knew this was going to be a challenge with the book. So I went and I wrote a tool that I can put basically comments into the code that indicate what version the master is, what chapter this chunk got introduced into.
Okay.
And so then you run the script and it takes the final project and it generates the chapters. So if you've got a bug that's in all five chapters, you just change it in one place and it splits it into these tiny little pieces. The amount of time it took to write that parser and get it working and doing all of that was significantly longer than any bug fix that I would have ever had to have put. But the flip side of it is it did give me more confidence that if I did have to fix a bug, that I was going to get it in all of the places. Because that's part right. of the fear is you're like, oh, that bug was in chapter 3 and I didn't realize it and I only fixed it in 4, 5, and 6. And so there's a quality thing. Listen to me rationalize, right? So some of the tinkering and problem solving type stuff with that kind of thing is, oh, I've got a solution to this, but, and maybe I shouldn't be doing it, but it's interesting and it's a neat little problem and now I'm doing it, right? So
yeah, I've noticed a few things. Like I get a lot of tinkering time in my job, in the sense that every 2 weeks we pick a particular project to play with and we're going to discuss them this week. And every week or multiple times a week, I'm checking out video courses and covering certain topics or potentially frameworks or other things. And so again, I'm kind of playing with them and learning them a little bit. Or even on an off week, I'm going to talk to somebody about this new tool that, you know, is creating something in PyScript. And so I have to play with it a little bit. And so it's eating up a lot of my, bandwidth for tinkering in some ways. And I feel like that happens sometimes, that if you get into a job where this was like the fun hobby that you had, you were kind of checking stuff out and now you're doing it for realsy.
Yeah.
As your jobby job, it sometimes eats away at that. And I feel that sometimes. And then I have a secondary problem, I would argue, that I mention this often about this sort of like spoiling creative spirit, but I for a long time, I wanted to be a recording engineer. Mostly, I learned all those skills to record my own music. And occasionally, I got to collaborate with people, and I worked I guess I don't talk about this often, but I worked on Tyrese Gibson's like first album, and I have a platinum record, you know, because of working on that album. And it was the best experience I've had in my life. I worked with a particular producer, this guy, Derek Allen, and it was very collaborative. Like I said, try this sound. He's looking for this. Okay, we'll try this instrument. He would try out this particular instrument that I owned. Oh, you should really use this particular effect pedal. And so it was super collaborative. And if I could have had that relationship going forward, I would have stayed in this thing and probably would be more of a recording engineer than I am now. I ended up moving on and becoming a teacher in recording engineering. And it's partly because the other 90% of the time when I was working that job, I was working on music and projects that really weren't very good, let alone great. And it was painful. And it was almost sort of sacrilegious to me to put all of this effort and time and so forth into something that I would never want anybody to know that I worked on, which mm-hmm. I know is like maybe mean or awful of me as a human being, but like I decided I don't want to be in that career.
It's mental energy. No, it's mental energy, right? You can, there's only so much, and I always find talking about this kind of funny, right? Because like I'm fully aware of the fact that being mentally tired is nowhere near being physically tired.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's a white collar
yeah.
first world problem.
Yep.
You know, and I look at what, you know, what my grandparents did for a living, and it's like, oh yeah, okay. they would have found me dead in a field already, right? But that being said, there is a mental thing. There's an exhaustion that comes with it. And, you know, if you're not there, you got to find some way to reduce it. And tinkering in projects sometimes rejuvenates that, yeah. Right? Like, so sometimes it's a, hey, this isn't the crappy code I'm working on in my daytime job. So now I'm trying to right. solve a problem that's a little different. You know, I often find, you know, that the one of the explanations between extroverts and introverts is that, you know, an extrovert is somebody who gets energy from people, and an introvert is, you know, they can enjoy interacting with people, but it's tiring.
Right.
And I think the tinkering, there's programmers who it's like, no, I'm done. I can't look at another line of code. And then there's right. other programmers. It's like, oh, as long as I'm not looking at that code, this code is interesting.
Yeah.
And it's sort of that introversion, you know, it's the extroversion equivalent, right? Is I'm getting energy from playing with this.
Yeah. I feel like I can take that metaphor even further, that I feel like the spark often for me, I've said this in other contexts, but it's just that it's tied to collaboration. And I think that's what my fascination with open source is, even though I'm still not jumping in with both feet there. I'm basically trying to find the projects that I want to do it. But I feel that sort of back and forth is something that I like in creative pursuits. And I wonder sometimes if there's other ways outside of maybe, you know, open source or what have you to kind of play with it. Like I thought a makerspace would be more like that for me, for like electronics projects and things like that, that I would be, you know, able to kind of talk to people more and so forth. And it didn't quite turn out that way for me. Of course, I didn't spend that much time exploring it, but I feel that coding is so often a solo thing. Mm-hmm. And when I'm trying to learn something brand new, like when I was trying to learn SQL or trying to learn web, you know, programming in JavaScript, or my very first stuff with Python, it was like a boundless energy. And then, you know, when it becomes a job, it becomes something slightly different. And so it's like, that is a trick of being a great programmer. It's like, okay, well, how do you keep the spark going? Speaking of stuff that keeps your interest going, we got some projects this week. I found a project that is by Simon Willison, and there's a bunch of other collaborators on this particular project. And I know I seem to be all about scraping the web lately, but this one is slightly different. It's called shot-scraper. It's a command line utility for taking automated screenshots of websites. Think of you trying to stitch together pictures of the entire page of a website going from top all the way you could scroll to the bottom, kind of like that ridiculous receipt you might get from CVS. You know, the ones you could knit into a bag that you could maybe carry your items out into. Anyway, this does that automatically. And I love this project right away because it was really easy to install. And it even requires a bunch of additional tools that would be some legwork for you. Simon's built in this install command that installs the Chromium tool and Playwright and all these other kind of stuff to go with it, which is great. And this default action just does that. It just grabs the page of whatever, you know, website you enter into it. You can, you know, choose whatever site you want. In this case, I tried it with his example site. I love the tutorials on this thing. They're really well done. But I went ahead and did one for Real Python, and it made a big list of the front page from there. You could say, okay, I want just these headings. I want just these areas. Really great documentation. I mean, just look at this project for like how you should organize documentation. It's really, really well done. I was very impressed with it. Again, a good tutorial, a section on how you can use it with websites that need authentication. He has actually built a little toy authenticated site on his own that you can then practice with that, which I love that about the tutorial. So very, very thorough. I'm impressed with it. And if this is something you need to do, I have bought screen grabbing utilities that try to do this sort of automatically for you. And this one just is way more controllable from the command line. Do you want it to output as a PDF? Do you want it output as this image? You know, what sort of boundaries of pixels do you want as far as the width and height and so forth? So I'm impressed by the project, Shop Scraper.
I think that just sort of brings us back to that tinkering thing. The difference between tinkering and producing a library is just how many people like it.
There you go.
Simon seems to tinker and the world seems to go, oh, I'll have that. Thank you.
And yeah, then, well, he seems to get lots of collaborators. So.
And then it's a project.
Yeah, exactly.
So good for him.
Yeah.
So my turn. Yes. Okay. So a few weeks back in episode 198, wow, time flies. Holy cow. I talked about the Django TUI, which was a terminal user interface program for the commands that you can run from within your Django project. This week, I've got a project that was inspired by that one called Django Admin TUI, and it's by Vior Valberg Gjølmundsson. Normally, the Django Admin is a web-based tool for managing your ORM objects that you have in your project. This library is a TUI for this same thing. It's kind of hard to say a lot about this project as it's exactly what it says it is. You pip install it, add it to your installed apps listing, and then there's a new command called admin TUI. When you run that, you get a textual interface that's identical to the web experience. It has three panes, one for the listing of your kinds of objects, one for controls like the add object button, and one for the listing of your objects that you're looking at in the tree. Something I find interesting about this approach is it could allow you to be much more paranoid about your web interface. You could block the admin web pages for your site and still be able to use the tool, but only if you're logged into your server. So that might be, you know, if you're security conscious, this would be another way of locking things down and not giving up this feature from Django. So neat little tool. While I'm on the topic of Django admin tools, I also want to give a shout out to Django Admin Dracula by Sangeeta Jadunanan. And if you're tired of the default Django admin look, this is a dark mode Dracula theme. Once you pip install it, you add it to your installed apps listing above the contrib.admin line, and there you go. You've got dark mode. Horrible Transylvanian accent, purely optional.
Very nice. Do you see yourself using something like the TUI one? Do you think that would be handy? I'm trying to think of circumstances where you would maybe not have the web interface, or that it might be more lightweight, or I'm trying to think of what.
Yeah, so if you were doing work on a server that you wanted to be down for some reason, this would allow you to be able to essentially get at your programmatic things for your database the same way with the web interface without the web there. I could see it possibly being helpful, like if you're setting a brand new site up. So for example, I'll go in and I'll put something in and I'll add a new subdomain and it hasn't gone through yet. And you want to test that things are working properly and you want to put something in the database and the web's not there yet. And so by having this tool there, you'd be able to play with it without the web until the web thing had been fixed. It's more as with a lot of the textual stuff, I think it always comes back to, can you? Oh, yes, you can. All right. whether or not how many people find that useful, well, whatever. But it's an interesting idea.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for bringing all these news items, topics, and projects this week again from PyCoders, Christopher.
See you in a couple weeks.
Actually, a quick update. Did you get any additional submissions from our call to action earlier?
It's hard to know. It's some weeks I get lots and some weeks I don't. So maybe.
Okay.
The dry spell has lifted. I don't want to say causation yet. So keep them coming.
Yeah, definitely. I'll include the link again for submissions at the bottom of the show notes. So please check out your show notes. Thanks. And don't forget to check out the Windsurf Editor, the next generation in AI-powered IDEs. Visit windsurf.ai to learn more and try out the world's first agentic editor for free. I want to thank Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again. And I want to thank you for listening to the Real Python Podcast. Make sure that you click that follow button in your podcast player. And if you see a subscribe button somewhere, remember that the Real Python Podcast is free. If you like the show, please leave us a review. You can find show notes with links to all the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and look forward to talking to you soon.